So, hi. Oh, you're not ready. Hi. Oh, you're ready now. Okay. It's great to be here. Thanks, Matthias, for asking me. When Matthias asked me a long time ago, he wrote an email saying that it would be nice if some of the softer sides of this whole complex was covered by someone. And of course, you know, the enormous gender bias of this whole event is a fascinating thing. So here I am, a true minority this time. So, Digital Commons Through History, which is the title of the program, is actually a slightly misleading title. This is the original, it's better, but it's perhaps a bit too long. From lopping and gleaning to googling and sampling, a brief history of the commons from rural to digital space. So, what I would like to do in this talk is to give a slightly different perspective, I think, on intellectual property or on the current intellectual property debate, as it were. Media wants sound bites, we all know that, and the record industry with its lobbyists and the pirates with their lobbyists have come to dominate the public perception, in Sweden at least, I would argue today, about what the copyright wars are about, which is deeply unfortunate. It's a topic for quite a different talk, but something I wanted to have said. File sharing is in fact only a tiny tip of a much larger iceberg, and what I would like to do today is to go underwater a bit. So I'll try not to talk for more than tops 40 minutes. I've asked Matthias to signal me when it sort of becomes crucial. Could be shorter than that depending on how fast I talk, which should give us time to have a discussion or some sort of Q&A period then at the end of this. Two quotes by two very famous IP scholars, or scholars in the field of intellectual property, broadly defined, can illustrate the kind of journey I would propose that we do together. It's by now taken for granted that we are facing, indeed, have been facing for quite some time, what James Boyle refers to as a second enclosure movement. Or, in somewhat different terms, but having the same general tendency in mind, that we witness what Henry Jenkins calls a digital land grab. Well, if something is the second coming, as it were, then there is also a first enclosure movement. And a significant part of my talk concerns the lessons that we might draw from this particular historic event. And the simple reason behind this is that the first enclosure movement carries enormous symbolic weight when trying to understand and interpret what's happening today. Of course, it's not necessary for me, particularly not in a context such as this one, to underline that there's a huge difference between the resources being fought over during the first movement and those being contested during the present and second one. So I'm not arguing, I hope I'm not arguing anyway, that the lessons we can draw from territorial land in the old sense simply can be brought over into the digital domain. But as I hope to show and passionately believe, we do need conceptual help in trying to mount defenses against copyright expansionism. And I think we have reached a point today where we spend too much time recycling familiar positions, and we need to look in other directions and use a different rhetoric, particularly if we are to engage a larger constituency of stakeholders in society for these issues, and we really do need to do that, I think. This lecture is based on a chapter in my new book, Terms of Use. Johan advertised his book shamelessly, so I can do the same. It was published a month ago by the University of Toronto Press, where I have a jungle theme, but I also have a big chapter on the history of the commons. So this is based on that chapter. The developments in IP, the expansion we know has taken place in space, in time, and in subject matter. It has also led to an increasing interest in two particular concepts, interrelated but different from one another. The first one is, of course, the public domain. The obvious reason why something is in the public domain or falls into the public domain, where it, as the new shorter Oxford English Dictionary says, belongs to the public as a whole, especially not subject to copyright, is of course that copyright has expired. There are other reasons as well, but that's the most simple one. The second term is of course the commons. There are gazillions of definitions of the commons. This is from the Oxford English Dictionary. Provisions provided for a community or a company in common. As I said, these two concepts, it would lead too far to sort of make a detailed discussion about the differences between them. They do point in a similar direction. They point towards the importance of keeping things open or sustainable uses, which is another thing we return to, the importance of sustainable uses of resources. So, the first enclosure movement, it takes place from 1235 with the Statute of Merton up until around the mid-1800s, 1860s, the 1860s in England. So we're talking about an extremely protracted process of fencing in what used to be open lands. The commons was never a space of absolute freedom, and of course I'm not talking about freedom in any sense, I would argue perhaps in my talk. It was never a space of absolute freedom before the enclosure of land. Vested in the lord of the manor, the de facto ownership of common lands were never in question. Technically, they were the wastes of the manors in which they were situated. What prevented the immediate and wholesale enclosure of common land was a long-standing recognition of the rights to specific, often highly regulated and customary uses. And use is, of course, a central dimension in this whole, in the whole copyright or IP dilemma that we're currently discussing, and one that will carry over in different ways into our own time. Tenants of the manor privy to such uses included commoners who owned land, those occupying cottages, inns, and mill houses, and on the lowest rung of the ladder, landless commoners. All were entitled to use parts of the commons themselves for grazing or for gathering nuts. The common rights attached to the respective category were secured in a number of different ways, profoundly local. The profile of these usages depended on an almost infinite number of variables. Governed by lex loci, the local law of the manor, it regulated a use so ancient as to take on the right, the color of a right or a privilege. But the whole thing was seldom, if ever, written down. William Blackstone discusses this tradition of customary rights from the perspective of time and memory in his commentaries on the laws of England. The defense of a custom, either in a rural setting or as it attached to particular trades or groups in London, depends entirely upon immemorial and established usage. The use of the commons provided even the poorest with some sort of economy. Dung served as manure, bushes and fallen trees supplied heating, and loose wool caught on branches became blankets for cold winters. The commons offered a subsistence living that was coming under increased pressure, not only by enclosure, but also by a revolution in demographics, the growing demand for fuel caused by rapid urban expansion, and the crucial introduction of improvement as a key element of agriculture. And improvement is, of course, something that you also recognize in today's discourse on IP. G.M. Neeson has described it as an economy of enough. It's a feudal system, mark well, but it's an economy built on strong property relations, not of the kind that we think of today when we think of IP, but relations between people adhering to rights and obligations. Because property, as you know, or at least we know that Locke thought so, property also entailed propriety. So, if we try now to move during 20 minutes from rural to digital space, we can only do so in such a short time as I have to my disposal, through a few historical snapshots. And some very important ones will be omitted completely. For instance, I won't say anything about what Schader and Sunder calls the romance of the public domain. That is, the way in which openness actually for some groups in society, for instance, Aboriginal peoples, have been quite problematic, and where openness might not be the problem, but increased protection might be the solution. The openness may be a problem. We seldom talk about that, but that is an interesting aspect of the history of the public domain. The Diggers is, of course, the first instance of an historical opponent to enclosure. On April 1st, 1649, a small group of men, mostly men, some women, started digging on the common land of St. George's Hill in Walton, Surrey, to prepare it for sowing. Led by Gerard Winstanley, the Diggers had an ideological platform that survives through a number of fascinating pamphlets, letters, and texts, manifestos, that are sort of borderline religious tracts rather than political interventions or statements, but fascinating all the same. A very brief experiment, they did this on two places in Surrey during a year, basically, failed, and it's sometimes described as the very first communist project. Whether or not that's true remains, you know, open for debate. Winstanley wrote, anyway, "England is not a free people till the poor that have no land have a free allowance to dig and labour the commons." One of the most well-known of traditions tied to the commons was the right to glean or collect the uncut or fallen grain that had been left in the field after harvest. And this is the famous painting by Jean-François Milly, Les Glaneuses, from 1857. Interestingly enough, and as Paul Cole Saint-Amour has discussed in his book on Victorian writings, there is a proliferation of titles during the Victorian era, for instance, such as churchyard gleanings, gleanings from the poets, etc. So he argues that this is a time when gleaning also is transposed into the immaterial world, so to speak. It becomes something that is discussed at a time when authorship is undergoing tremendous change. Far from being an unimportant addition to the economy, gleaning could sometimes represent more than a tenth of a family's annual income, indicative of a much larger restructuring of practices that passed down through generations until becoming a ubiquitous part of commoners' lives. Gleaning has been described as a typical example of a custom-to-crime transition. That is, it was a customary use that the logic of enclosure translated into trespassing or illegal incursion on private property. Note the absence of men in Millet's painting. The practice of gleaning is particularly interesting because it was almost exclusively the province of women. A full 93% of the gleaners involved in disputes with farmers towards the end of the 18th century were women, whereas all of the farmers and landowners opposing them were men. The farmers were literate, but only 6% of the gleaners could sign their names. As a collective, gleaners acted in a tradition of civil disobedience that is similar to a history of enclosure riots that takes place in England during the history of enclosure. With the one difference that in this case, the rioters are all women, and accounts of the often heated conflict between farmers and gleaners reveal a determined and well-organized resistance. In fact, it's a striking feature about the organization of gleaners' protests that it depended on a highly detailed regulation among the members of the group themselves. Any transgressions violating the code of conduct that had been agreed upon resulted in immediate sanctions. I already noted when I started, the gender imbalance of this event, and of course the gender imbalance in the whole history of the commons is striking. I'm not sure if I'm certainly not a gender scholar myself, so I'm not sure if I have any solution to that, but it's certainly remarkable. This, however, is one woman with a very important role to play in the history of the commons in England. That is Octavia Hill. Because when we reach the mid-1800s, the battle for the rural commons, in the way that I've just described it, having to do with land and the uses of land, is irretrievably lost. Enclosure has been sort of a success story in England. And the struggle now moves elsewhere, and it moves into the burgeoning metropolis. So we have a very distinct link from a rural history into an urban history. And one woman who then would have a significant impact on the history of the commons in England, and especially around London, is Octavia Hill, who was a social reformer, best known for her work among the poor. And Hill is one of the founders of a very interesting organization called the Commons Preservation Society, which is founded in 1865 by John Stuart Mill, among others. Octavia Hill was a tireless advocate for open spaces and for the value of the commons. Each year around Christmas, she sent out a letter to her benefactors recapitulating the work she had done during the year gone by. And in this quote, she laments, she's very depressed in this particular letter, and she laments how difficult it is to raise an interest. It remains the hardest of all things to get either workers or money for the preservation of paths and commons, which are among our people's best possessions and are being yearly, yes, monthly, snatched from them. And in the sentence directly following her gloomy observation, she continues that I had to write this year two such begging letters as I have seldom in my life had to write to two old and tried friends who had already given me largely and generously. So she was out canvassing money to save some of the commons around London. So this might be shorter than I actually thought it would be. Oh, I never know. The Commons Preservation Society was involved in a number of lawsuits, none of which, according to Lord Eversley, who chaired the organisation for many years, was as important as that concerning Epping Forest. The Epping Forest case came to rest on the right of commoners to lop, and lop is basically the right to cut branches off trees for firewood during the winter months. The practice originated in a grant from Queen Elizabeth I and had all the hallmarks of strict self-regulating features of customary use. The wood had to be lopped between 11th of November and St. George's Day on 23rd of April. Only inhabitants of the parish could cut branches, and these were collected into 6 feet high piles drawn out of the forest on specially designed sleighs. Midnight marked the beginning of lopping, and when the people of the manor met on a hill within the forest, drank beer. There's actually a lot of beer drinking in the history of resistance to enclosure. You know, we are in the UK, so perhaps not so strange. Worked until 2 in the morning and then returned home. However, when time came for the annual tradition to take place in 1866, the area had been enclosed. In defiance of this new ordinance, a man named Willingale and his two sons tore the fences down and started to lop or cut branches just as they had done in the past. Although they relied on the right to lop in their defense, local judges deemed the Willingales guilty of trespassing on private property, and they were sentenced to 2 months in prison with hard labor. Because of pneumonia contracted in prison, one of Willingale's sons died, and upon his own release, Willingale Sr. was advised to seek the legal counsel of the Commons Preservation Society and go to court. Then a number of obstacles presented themselves, chief among these the fact that Willingale found it difficult to procure both employment and lodging in Loughton, and this was a prerequisite to begin a suit or to have a suit. A suit confirming and reinstating the right to lop was what he was after. And it was brought down in the name of the inhabitants of Loughton. Complicated again by Willingale's unfortunate, untimely death in 1870, before his day in court, the case lingered on for several years until a new commoner could be found in whose name the case could be taken. To make a very long story short, litigation continued for several years. The future control and management of Epping Forest was finally vested in the Corporation of London, with one provision. So, while the forest remained unenclosed and open to all, resistance against the common right to lop remained. Despite his own argument in favour of the tradition, Lord Eversley fought in vain against what he called the unworthy attempts of the corporation to prevent the continuation of the practice. On 10th of November 1879, so we're now 13 years after the initial incident, he was one of 5,000 or 6,000 people perambulating the forest by torchlight in a final token lopping ceremony. This story comes with a very interesting lesson, I think. So, although the most significant lesson from this story is this one. Although the Loughton inhabitants were awarded recompense for the loss of their common rights in the form of £7,000, this was money spent on building a village hall named the Loppers Hall. And I'm not sure if you can see this, but I don't have one of those to point with, but you can probably see the men lopping depiction. And of course it says Loughton above that, and it says Lopping Hall under that. So even though the Commons Preservation Society succeeded partly in their litigation, to future generations, lopping was celebrated inside the Loppers Hall rather than actively pursued on the grounds of the Commons. And so we have the Commons still open, but we have the practice of using the Commons removed from the users. And this is one of the significant lessons of the Commons history. A gradual, E.P. Thompson has written eloquently about this, a gradual separation of users' rights from users, so to speak. And this is what takes place here. So we get a kind of symbolic use of the Commons within the Loppers Hall, but we don't get it on the grounds. Now, from the Statute of Merton, by way of digger and gleaner resistance, via his fight for the London Commons and the arrival of a public, which I didn't get into, we find ourselves here and now. The media-saturated, online, globalized information age depends on an information commons, a word familiar to anyone who has ever used a well-stocked North American university library, where clusters of computers servicing the needs of faculty and students, and actually the public as well, usually is known by that very name. During 6 centuries, we have witnessed agricultural and local economies being replaced by capitalism and industrialization, and industrialization being superseded by the information age. Decentered and deterritorialized, at first sight, the concerns of this new commons appear very different from what was at stake when Winstanley and the diggers armed themselves with shovels and arguments from the Bible in their disputes more than 300 years ago. Rather than meadows, fish, or any other physical resource that may be subject to depletion or overuse, information, knowledge, symbols, and text make up the valuables we search for on never-ending digital grazing lands. The information commons represents, therefore, the ultimate disconnection from actual land, or it would seem that it represents the absolute disconnection from land. When using the term in the 21st century, we picture a virtual and digital space, and not the verdant hills and fields of England. Sorry, I just have to... Primarily, the productiveness of the information commons as a concept derives from our recognition of the specificity of the informational resource and its uses. The information commons is simply made of a very different raw material than soil, turf, and grass. Information-based resources are both non-rival. My use does not, I mean, you know all of this as a mantra. My use does not hinder yours. In fact, you and I can use the same resource simultaneously without no negative or detrimental effect, as well as non-excludable. We often hear that information can be costly to produce, but new technology makes it essentially impossible to hinder an infinite number of uses at zero marginal cost. The first criteria is essential for those scholars who in recent years have tried to disprove the applicability of Garrett Hardin's infamous concept, the tragedy of the commons. In a situation where information is both the outcome of and the very prerequisite for production. Indeed, the tragedy of the commons is a concept practically unavoidable in any study that looks into the history and theory of the commons, regardless of epistemological inclinations. Hardin made one simple point. If you imagine a pasture open to all, each herdsman will not be altruistic, but instead he or she will try his or her utmost to keep as many cattle as possible on the commons, even when the end result proves detrimental to him or herself. Each man is locked into a system that compels him to increase his herd without limit, in a world that is limited. Ruin is the destination to which all men rush, each pursuing his own best interests in a society that believes in the freedom of the commons. Freedom in a commons brings ruin to all. I'm sure you've read this, it's a fairly short piece from, I think, Science or Nature in 1968, and he was talking about overpopulation, which is often forgotten when we quote him. So, a state of, as long as there's a functioning balance between what the land can hold and how we use it, everything is just dandy. Unfortunately, this state of equilibrium cannot be maintained, according to Hardin, because the inherent logic of the commons remorselessly generates tragedy. However, E.P. Thompson put it very well when he said that commoners were not without common sense. And as Eleanor Ostrom and Carol Rose have argued in their important writings, Ostrom has written one of the most important books in looking at the history of the commons, Governing the Commons, the Evolution of Institutions for Collective Action, from 91. What she shows is that there is a remarkable plethora of examples from a middle ground, where the answer to the problems of the commons is neither complete privatization nor absolute statist intervention. One of the major dilemmas of these two basic solutions that tend to be called upon to solve the risk of overutilization is that both are imposed from outside or above on those who use the commons. Both represent top-down solution to bottom-up practices. In fact, what we term open access regimes in the way of Hardin's argument are more likely common property regimes, at least that's what Carol Rose would call them, where informal mechanisms of control may quite effectively regulate the use of the resource in question. Farmers in Andalusia manage very well on their own, successfully allocating water through a complex system of irrigation and settling disputes through the formation of a self-governing tribunal in the town square. Surfers, I read a very interesting, very funny legal piece of a lawyer, a law scholar, wrote an article, he was Australian, he wrote a long article on how surfers share waves in California and Australia. And he argued that surfers rely on certain norms and informal codes in order to ensure that their usage of waves is consistent with what the community of surfers would expect and consider moral. So, I come to my final points. So, what can we possibly learn? We must be able to learn something, hopefully. If we surface from this, looking at this iceberg, where file sharing is a bit just a tiny tip, we can see a few things. Absolutely fundamental from this exposé, this historical trajectory, I think, is to understand that land is important only second, and use is important first. So what we talk about, I think, when we talk about the commons today, is forms of usage. And it's the concept of common right, the right to use the commons as symbolic or tangible land that we talk about when we talk about the commons, rather in the old meaning of territory or in the more metaphorical present meaning. So, ostensibly, enclosure is about land, but what it brought about on a much more profound level was a radical change in traditions and custom relating to the fabric of social life as a whole. And I think this is something that is, if not directly transferable into the digital domain, it is certainly something worth keeping in mind. The second lesson about the commons is that it was never free. Oops. Or rather, it was never completely deregulated. It was completely regulated. But it depended on codes of conduct and, if not, you know, hard law, then forms of soft law, rather, or agreements, moral supervision, if you will. So if we want to defend the value of sharing and keeping things open, and I think we do, we should probably expand our rhetoric somewhat. And in my book, I tried to sort of look at an alternative, imaginative space to situate this discussion in. And that four things could serve as a kind of, you know, bullet points for this. I think we need to rethink value. I need for true sustainable development in the internet, in the information society. And it's a wise thing, I think, to talk about sustainable development in the realm of information, as it is to talk about it in the realm of sort of land proper. We need to articulate value better, and we need to remove it from a too narrow domain, too narrow economical domain. We need to think about where value arises in these systems and what kind of value we think is important for society. Here we have institutions that should, to a higher degree, say something about these problems than they're doing. Libraries is one such institution. It's one of the most popular institutions we have in this country. They have yet to say anything interesting on these dilemmas, which I try to tell them as much as possible. Universities is another institution that is being increasingly under pressure from IP, the development of IP, and that really should try and resist it better, rather than simply say that give us the more patents and, you know, we will have more money, basically, which is now taking place across the board, I would say. Nobody in the university is questioning whether or not this is the right way to go, whereas we have evidence from the US from the beginning of the 80s with the Bayh-Dole Act that encouraging universities to patent is not necessarily the best way to go about things. Well, there are some very depressing lessons to be learned from that. I'm not advocating the removal or the eradication of copyright. I realize its relevance for people, artists, musicians, authors, but it's clear to me that they're not necessarily the ones who have benefited from the expansion of copyright during the last 20 years or so. I do think that these creators need to understand and acknowledge that they too are users. We're all users. And if the raw material we need to do new things is taken away from us, we will all suffer from that. So we need to start talking about users' rights. And of course, this is a tradition in the Anglo-American scholarship that has been going on for a long time. L. Ray Patterson wrote a book already in the 1980s about copyright as a user's right. The third thing, which I think I've started to think about a lot myself and I'm fascinated with, is one size does not fit all. The record industry and the file sharers, or rather the record industry and the focus on music, is a bit problematic because I think it has caused us to think that all creative industries are advocating higher IP protection. Of course, this is not true. The record industry might do it. But there are other creative industries that actually can opt for lower IP protection, even if they have the possibility of grabbing higher IP protection. The fashion industry is one example of that. I read three brilliant articles a while ago, one on fashion, one on magicians, how they protect their IP, and one on French gourmet chefs. And you know, they might sound a bit off, and certainly not, you can't sort of, you know, do too much of it. But what they help us do is to see that there are creative industries that actually are based on norms and decisions that don't necessarily push them towards harder IP, because they know that the innovation circle, particularly in fashion, will lose out if it's too much IP. So they choose lower IP in order to have an innovation circle that works. We should try and find more examples of this kind so that we can exemplify with the help of such different industries when we're trying to mount defenses against copyright expansionism. So, and the final thing is, a question that I tend to ask myself over and over again, should the law solve problems caused by the law? Because this is, you know, we tend to think that this is the way to go about things. And I had this discussion with my students. I give a course on the cultural history of copyright. And we had this discussion about the fact, we read a very good article by Jason Mazon, Copy Fraud, which is about, you know, the way that cultural heritage institutions tend to put a copyright sign on things that are in the public domain. It's a huge problem. And what Mazon says is that there is no public domain symbol. I actually think there's a public domain symbol in Creative Commons. I mean, isn't there something? But there's no group working in WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, which is a UN organization based in Geneva, devoted to the public domain. So I was thinking, why do we always have these new copyright commissions? You know, we have, and they're supposed to come up with something new, and they never come up with something new. In the worst case scenario, they roll us back even further into this discussion. So it seems to me that it would be much better to work for a public domain commission. You know, this it will be tricky because it's difficult to discuss these values because we will have so many versions of them. But why not sort of reclaim the value of openness, the public domain, the commons, and sort of argue that we begin in that end instead of just having yet another copyright commission on our hands. So, yes, two very, very brief images. From April 1st, I lead the Swedish part of a project that has the acronym COUNTER, and that looks kind of scary when you look at it, that consists of four other partner universities in Vienna, Milan, the UK, and Slovenia. And we're one of the first projects to have received support from the 7th framework in the EU. And this is a 24-month project on copyright, file sharing, consumer perspectives, also on counterfeiting. So we deal both with tangible goods and non-tangible goods. And we will also, Uppsala, I lead a work package, as it's called in EU language, basically a project within the project, on copyright and collaborative practices, where we will be looking at the relationship between copyright and cultural heritage institutions and collaborative practices also on the net. So the website is up and running, and we recently, and Matthias helped me post, you posted the call, didn't you? Yeah. on your blog. We have a call open now for a workshop in Uppsala to take place next May. And at Uppsala, I lead what hopefully will be a more formalized network on culture, creativity and copyright across the faculties at Uppsala. We have organized conferences, seminars. We hope to get some more money. I've been invited to present both Counter and CCC for the Vice Chancellor in 2 weeks, the day before they make the decision on funding for the next year. So I'm nervous, but you could keep your fingers crossed to see if we get any money for this kind of research. So I'll just end with my favorite quote by Justice Story. In truth, in literature, in science, and in art, there are and can be few, if any, things. Actually, this is the way the comma is, so it's not me having, you know, which in an abstract sense are strictly new and original throughout. Every book in literature, science, and art borrows, and must necessarily borrow, and use much which was well known and used before. No man writes exclusively from his own thoughts, unaided and uninstructed by the thoughts of others. Thank you. So, any questions?
My name is Stefan Larsson. I am a social legal student or scientist.
Oh, you gave the talk earlier.
I'm
sorry
speech.
About that.
It's okay.
You talked about the limits of the law, perhaps.
That was what I wanted to comment about, because I totally agree on the thing to the extent that the knowledge base in the investigations today are, I mean, they appoint a lawyer to do a dogmatic legal research, and the answer is always the law can't be wrong. I mean, we need more law or follow the track. So it's more like the knowledge base that we need more knowledge of the kind perhaps you're
not more lawyers
advocating
then.
Here. Not more lawyers, but or lawyers that can't think outside the dogma kind of. So we need investigations that are more broader.
Yeah.
I totally agree on that.
I think the fascinating thing about the legal traditions that they are so different is that when you look at the kind of interdisciplinary research that has grown up around Copyright International, you will see that it's very dominated by Anglo-American scholars. And I think it has lots to do with the fact that the tradition of doing critical research in the legal domain in the US and the UK, and also Australia, Canada, wherever, is much stronger than in Sweden. Whereas in Sweden, you will see some people, and most of them, you can disagree if you think I'm wrong, but many of them, at least, know that what takes place now is wrong. I mean, but they still cannot sort of get out of the way that they are trained to think, and they're trained to think about the law as is, not, you know, perhaps if it's bad or, you know, we can do something with it.
I agree on this thing too.
And that is a huge problem for, I think, the way research on these issues have not taken off in Sweden, because if we had wiser lawyer, legal scholars who looked at things differently, I think we would have a much better situation, because we need them, absolutely. But
if I may comment on
sure.
I think one reason could be, I studied law for 5 years in Sweden, and the perspective is always dogmatic. You have to interpret law and apply it. This is the right way to do it, kind of, and never practical, you know, which in my sense, I believe that in America, they have more of a practice. How should we use law? And which gives a more critical perspective and finds the edges or the holes in it. A critical perspective, which we don't have. So that could be one of the reasons. We don't have that culture, kind of. So we don't have any researchers either, research groups who studies law and kind of criticizes it in Sweden. When we have it in America, I mean,
we have lots of
there are groups,
yeah,
a different culture. That's a problem in Swedish law.
Yeah, I think there are individuals. I mean, you know,
yeah,
immaterialrätten in Stockholm is the big, I mean, there's a group here at Chalmers too, but most of them are very, as you say, very narrow-minded. Mm. And I would also even suggest that they are in bed with industry to a very high degree.
Yeah.
So, but there are individuals who try their best, but it is kind of depressing to see that problem.
Can I ask if it's more unperturbing from Don't Free Software a couple of years? Isn't it maybe also interest groups and such that are not in place? You recently did another law that is interesting from a free culture, free software perspective, the surveillance law in Sweden. Tried to do that in Norway, we'll just be thrown out of the politicians because we were kind of occupied. We know how fascism worked, and we have some personal experience, not the young one, but the older ones, and we have inherent that in our culture. Mm-hmm. And we have also lobby groups who are actively opposing the DRM laws. We have just opposing the government.
Yeah.
And it seems that the Swedish just don't do that.
No.
They're just accepting things, or they decided, but we have to apply. If you try to do that to a Norwegian, they just get angry and say it's the state, they're stupid, go home. And you have the same criticism. In American culture, that they are kind of skeptical to the government, or that seems to be in Sweden, maybe in Denmark. So why not try that one to organize yourself, also do some asking some question when new policy is suggested, also from the scientists. In Norway, we have examples of scientists when it comes to copyright law, where legal representative at the legal university say this is the law, this is how it should be. But other scientists come along and say, well, you're representing this interest, but we have also other interests to take into consideration when it comes to copyright law and such. Maybe the balance is wrong, maybe we should do something else because we have other interests.
I agree completely, as I mentioned libraries before, and I think that there's a huge difference between how the library community in the US has acted on copyright expansionism and how they have acted in Sweden. And you know, this is due to many different things, of course, because there are other issues in the States. But libraries have been on the forefront of the critique against copyright expansionism, both individuals and institutions in the US. We've seen nothing of that here. The British Library wrote in 2006 an excellent intellectual property manifesto, which sort of, you know, discussed the balance in copyright and tried to argue for users' rights, etc., etc. But it seems as if these institutions are really scared here. They're very scared to they're scared to say something, and it's a bit difficult for me to understand. I mean, I can rationalize it and I can understand parts of it, but it's still. It's very strange to me that an institution such as libraries, or specifically academic libraries or research libraries, don't say more than they do.
I'm afraid that Sweden will lag behind in a knowledge society if you're locking down your staff by proprietary interests.
Sure.
New expansionism is obvious.
Yeah.
And they just copy the worst of the copyright law from other countries that does not really work.
Sure.
Instead of asking the question, which going to gain and which going to lose, and how are we really going to take on? Because we know that people who are working with creativity, writing articles and such, they need to get paid. We acknowledge that.
Mm.
But the other of your interest is teaching, knowledge sharing,
sure.
How we build a whole free software community. It's using those, the benefit of sharing knowledge to everyone.
Well, the Science Commons is one of the oldest commons we know of. So, I mean, this is obviously an area where there are very important values of openness to defend. So, and that's why it's extremely depressing to see.
My question is, are Sweden willing to, because we don't focus on it, to lag behind in the knowledge society? That's the basic
line. I'm not sure if I'm...
You don't need to answer as a scientist, but maybe as a scientist asking the question, who does this gain as you know what to do in your science is a good thing, because fingers on it. And it's copyright expansionism from a small part of the industry, because that,
yes.
that's who it is. It's, we know even the name of this those companies, and they are building on other, you know, internet or other internet innovation that has been actually open, so they have succeeded immensely and earn a lot of money. So it's kind of double standard in communication here.
Well, I'm sure the government wouldn't reply, yes, we would want to lose out in the global race for, you know, I'm sure they're thinking that what they do will benefit Sweden as a knowledge-based nation, but I agree completely with your analysis of the problems.
Take one instance, for instance, the DRM thingy or the iTunes, that is not a case from Norway, it's originated in Norway. They said, you are locked into this product, it's not allowed. But before they said that, they teamed up with the European countries. Sweden was there, I think Denmark was there. Now they're saying, we have Germany is with us, France is with us, the consumer office in EU is with us, Norway not even being a member of EU, only by the trade agreement. And Sweden does not use more resources on it, and Denmark has stopped using it. But, you know, Netherlands, even Great Britain, and Germany and France is joining this effort. So it seems that you are starting and asking questions, and then you retract. And Norwegian pay the cost. Why shouldn't you just join? You can just sit in some meetings and say, yeah, we agree with you, with free coffee. So you know.
Not free beer. But
yeah,
free
not
coffee,
free coffee.
Right? Yeah.
I don't drink, so I can't.
That's fine.
But the thing is that I ask this question because you can see those cases. You're going to do science now on that. And you can see how it goes and what argument they're using. And from a scientific perspective, it's very good. But from my, and I think maybe this is why you're here, also that free software people should go to the parliament in Sweden and ask those questions because they are trying this expansionism. And are you in favor of supporting the young people that are going to create the next Bill Gates or the next Tim Berners-Lee or next Einstein? And taking away the means they need to create the future. This is what this politician is about now, in some countries, not everywhere, but in some countries.
Yes,
I was thinking you rightly mentioned that Hardin's concept of the tragedy of the commons relates to the Malthusian talk about the principle of population. And that concept has been very widespread and very widely accepted despite its quite obvious flaws in an industrial society. I wanted to know what your thoughts are on the effect that the Malthusian claim had has had on the formulation of copyright.
I'm not sure if I'm able to answer that question, actually.
Is it something you need time for?
No, I don't think I'm just... Oh, yeah, I know. We need to end. No, I'm not sure I'm competent to answer the question, basically. That would be my reply.
Sorry.
No, why be sorry? Okay, thank you. We need to get to move on. Because. Thank you.